The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic that I thought of talking about today is inspired from a question from last week. And this comes up over and over again, actually. How do we work in the midst of our daily lives when we're reacting to something so quickly in the present moment? You know, thoughts just kind of quickly come up, and reactivity and emotions, it all just like explodes in a split second, and then we're saying something we don't want to say, or acting in a way that's not so helpful in a situation. And so this is, this is the great question: how do we cultivate the peace, the ease, the skillfulness, right in the midst of our daily lives? In sitting practice, you know, so there's a contrast. There is a contrast, and this is something a lot of people point to, that what we work on in sitting, you know, in so many ways, sitting is the easy thing. You know, it's not, and even sitting is not very easy. We see just how much our minds wander, and how much we get caught even in the sitting practice. You know, some thought comes up about some situation that we're in daily life, and whew, our thoughts charge out of the present moment, and we're experiencing reactivity. And in that, however, in the sitting practice, we at least have some opportunity to wake up. You know, that in the sitting, you know, we're sitting still. And most of us do that. I mean, it's interesting how our thoughts can just be charging, and yet we're sitting here like this, you know. And and it's like, you know, that very stillness supports our waking up in many ways. So the practice of sitting is helpful, because we in the process of sitting remember at some point, you know, we're sitting there still, and then we wake up and we realize we're having this argument in our minds with some person, or we're acting something out in our minds, and it's like, oh, I'm sitting here still. I'm not actually having that argument with that person. And so that helps to wake us up. You know, so the structure of sitting practice helps to bring mindfulness back. And in that, as mindfulness returns, we have the opportunity, although most of us don't think of it as an opportunity, we have the opportunity in that moment to really start to turn towards what has arisen since our minds charged out of the present moment. You know, when we do experience reactivity when we are sitting, if a thought comes up about some charged situation in our lives, very often it's not that, you know, the stillness of the body supports our waking up, but the stillness of the body doesn't mean that the mind stays still. And it doesn't mean that the heart doesn't start to race. And so as the mind goes out and does its thing, it creates a new climate in our minds and in our bodies. And the opportunity in the sitting practice is that we can start to wake up to those experiences, get familiar with what it's like to be experiencing anger or frustration or irritation or impatience or confusion or pride or whatever is our favorite flavor of the moment. So that is an opportunity in sitting practice, to begin to get familiar. And this is one of the things that does support us in daily life. If in our sitting practice we are simply, and this is a form of sitting practice, so I'm not saying it's inappropriate to do this, but in our sitting practice, if we are just, oh, there's something that's happening in the mind, let that go and come back to the breath, we're missing that opportunity to really start to get familiar with what does it mean to be present for that reactivity. And this practice of opening to reactivity in our sitting does support the process over time of beginning to wake up and be available for that reactivity in the midst of our lives. And so this is one of the practices that supports us in our daily lives. If we explore the sitting practice as an opportunity, when our minds wander and get reactive, instead of feeling like that's a problem, like, oh, I'm doing the meditation wrong, I'm supposed to stay with the breath. If instead of feeling like that's a problem, we look at it as an opportunity to explore what has arisen in that moment in a contained situation, in a controlled situation, where we're not right in front of the person that we're arguing with, or we're not in the situation that's creating that reactivity, in that moment, we can learn what it means. Ah, this is what it means to be a human being that's angry. These are the thoughts that come up. This is the way the body tends to react. This is the way the mind tends to react. So we get familiar with that in our sitting practice. And that familiarity in our sitting practice helps us in our daily life because we start to get familiar with, you know, in our sitting practice, we actually have the opportunity to start to see kind of the onset of reactivity and get familiar with, okay, how can I be with this without letting the mind spin out? How can I be with this feeling of frustration or impatience or anger without letting the mind kind of spin out into more thoughts? This kind of cycle, there's a cycle in our usual way of dealing with the world that when we have a thought that produces some kind of reactivity, that reactivity in turn produces thoughts that tend to fuel the reactivity. And so if we can, in mindfulness practice, start to just feel into, ah, this is the experience of the reactivity. This is what it's like to be a human being that's feeling impatience. If we can feel into that, then that tends to cut the chain of thinking that follows off from that reactivity. And it's like taking the gas off the gas pedal. You know, the car, or the, you know, if you take the gas off the gas pedal, and I think somebody pointed out putting the car into neutral, which is actually what mindfulness kind of does in our minds. It puts our mind into neutral. And you put a car into neutral when it's going 60 miles an hour down the freeway, you know, it doesn't come to a stop immediately, but it will roll to a stop. And very similarly with our reactivity, when we take our foot off the gas pedal of thoughts, the pattern of reactivity doesn't come to an immediate stop, but it has an opportunity to kind of roll to a stop and be witnessed in that way. And so we learn that skill in sitting meditation. We start to learn that skill of how to take our foot off the gas pedal of the thoughts and hang out with the reactivity, the feeling in the body, the feeling in the mind. We learn that skill in sitting meditation. And then it is not easy to transfer that skill into daily life. It isn't easy, I will say that. And yet it is possible. And so, you know, it's practice. It's practice that we cultivate. There's, you know, I sometimes use an analogy around practicing in daily life being like practicing for a team sport. You know, if we want to learn how to play some kind of team sport like basketball, you know, we don't start by putting ourselves in the middle of a professional basketball game to try to learn how to play the game. We learn the rules first. You know, we learn something about the structure of the game, and then we practice by ourselves with the moves. And then we start to play with friends, somebody we trust who's not going to, like, you know, roll us over. And then we maybe go into a pickup game in the neighborhood and start to play, people that we don't know and see, you know, how do my skills, how can I increase my skills in that kind of a situation? And so in learning a team sport, you know, we're very aware of the kind of incremental development of our skill. And it's very similar with this skill of learning how to be with our reactivity in the midst of our daily lives. It is a skill, and it can be learned. And this, you know, this practice of exploring our reactivity as it arises in sitting is the very first place to cultivate that skill. So in taking the practice into daily life, I think there's a couple of main areas that we need the most practice with. And one is this area of reactivity, which happens so fast. And the other is the area of thoughts and speech. You know, that we in our sitting meditation, one of the things that we have the opportunity to do in our sitting meditation actually is to let go of thoughts and just come into our experience of the moment. Well, in daily lives, we don't quite have that luxury because we do have to think in our daily lives. We have to plan, we have to reflect on what we're going to say to people. So we have to think and we have to speak in our daily lives. And this is an area in particular that, that we need to cultivate explicitly in our daily lives. How do we work with thought? How do we work with speech? And seeing the interplay between thoughts and emotional reactivity, as I just mentioned, you know, that when there is emotional reactivity, it tends to fuel more thoughts, which tends to fuel more emotional reactivity. So we see a cycle between these two areas, between our thoughts and our emotional reactivity. So I'll talk a little bit about working with each. And hopefully leave some time for questions at the end, because this is always such a juicy topic. It's sometimes helpful to explore what's happening for you in your lives and how to work with that. So with working with thoughts and speech, working with thoughts, I think, again, to follow the analogy of the basketball, We can play with, first of all, exploring a little bit in our sitting practice of not being quite so dismissive of thoughts, but of actually starting to recognize, oh, this is what the experience of thinking is. So we begin, again, in our sitting practice in the most controlled kind of practice situation. When a thought arises, rather than saying, oh, bad thought, I'm not supposed to be thinking when I'm meditating, ask the question, how might it be possible to be mindful of thinking? How might it be possible to know thought? And one of the key ways to explore that is, there's a thought that arises. How does it impact you? Thoughts are so powerful. Thoughts are amazingly powerful in terms of their ability to impact our present moment experience. We'll try this right now. Just let your my eyes close and just take a couple of breaths. And I'm going to drop a couple of words into your meditation. And just see in the moment that I say these words, what happens to your body? What happens to your mind? So taking a couple more breaths. Anxiety. What happens to your body and your mind as that word lands? See if you can let that go and come back to your breath again. How about the word peace? Okay, you can open your eyes. I didn't put the mics out. Let me get the mics. I want to hear how that was, if anybody noticed anything with those words. Anybody?
Anxiety produced a slight tension in my body, and my mind went sort of aversive. I don't want that. And peace, the first thing I thought of is a beautiful piece of music by somebody named Peace, called Peace Peace. And it's very soft and lovely, and I softened.
Anyone else? Yeah.
I think often that peace is a good thing, but it's not enough. It's if I'm still fragmented in my being, or afflicted by desire, I can have peace and still have this sense of fragmentation and desire, and I need something a little bit more than that. For me, wholeness is a higher, higher value than peace.
But did you experience a shift with the words? That's mostly what I was interested in.
A shift with the words. I don't know if I did or not.
Okay. Anyone else experience a shift with the words? Just raise your hand if you experienced something in the... Okay, so several of you did experience a shift. And what I want to point out with this is that this was two words that I dropped in. There were words I picked and put into your mind. And there was something that happened for many of you, a shift in your mind, a shift in your body. Now imagine what happens when a whole thought comes into your mind and the power of that thought. I picked a word, a few very conscious words to notice, see if you could notice something happening. But just this points to the power of thought to influence your experience. That's the main thing I wanted you to notice there. And so as the mind starts thinking in our meditation, you know, if we think, oh, thought, put it aside and come back to the breath and ignore what has happened as a result of the thought arising, then we're again missing another opportunity. We're missing an opportunity to explore what is the impact of thought on our experience and how might it be possible to be mindful both of the thought and the impact. So playing with that in our sitting meditation, again, not having this kind of cut-and-dried idea that meditation means no thought, but instead of the cultivation of the practice of mindfulness, we cultivate mindfulness of thought, mindfulness of how thoughts impact us. And so again, this is the kind of beginning place for our practice with thoughts, is to explore in our sitting. And then, playing with practicing with this in daily life. Now, a good place to do this, you know, something where you're doing like a chore, you know, someplace, again, a kind of controlled situation. This would be, you know, kind of akin to, practicing on the basketball court by yourself, also, you know, the sitting practice is like that, but that's more like running it through your mind, you know, running through the moves in your mind on the back, you know, like when I was a dancer, I used to practice my dances in my mind. So similarly, we explore, you know, what is this thought? How does it impact our body as we're sitting still? And then moving more into daily life, you know, we can, while we're washing dishes or loading the dishwasher or clearing the table or loading or unloading the laundry, some simple chore that doesn't require much of our thinking because we know how to do it. It's not like we have to like plan out how to load the dishwasher so much. Well, there's a little bit of planning in there, but it's not like, huge. It's not like computer programming or fixing a car or something like that. You know, it's pretty simple. And so in that process of doing that, begin to notice the thoughts that arise. And you might explore, you know, where we're doing chores, you might explore putting a sign, you know, like in front of the sink, remember to be a mindful of thoughts. You know, so what's going on there? Just to help yourself to remember to do this practice. And just again to notice the way it works. You know, like if you're washing dishes, if you have had friends over and there's a big pile of dishes or putting dishes in the dishwasher. You know, you're doing that activity, and maybe as you're doing that, thoughts of the gathering come into your mind. And then that's pretty natural. But then we start thinking about it. Oh, that person said that and that wasn't so friendly, and I got kind of mad about that, and there we are. The reactivity has been born because of the associative nature of thought. And if we're not practicing with this, we're likely to end up lost in our reactivity. So this is the point for us in our practice with thoughts in daily life, is to begin to notice where thought moves or leaps or shifts from being kind of functional and reflective, like, so kind of normal, the associative nature, you know, you're putting the dishes away and the memory of the friends arise. You know, that's not particularly a problem. But then we start thinking about something that they said, and from there, that's when we leap, when we come up with something that either we really liked or we didn't like in our thoughts. And we start charging out of the present moment, or just, you know, wandering out of the present moment. We don't necessarily charge out, but just the mind just loses touch with the present moment. And so beginning to recognize that moment of when the pull to thoughts gets strong. So exploring this in daily life, beginning to recognize, support for this is a teaching from the Buddha around working with speech that we can apply to thoughts. And this is, are thoughts true? Are thoughts necessary? And are they kind? And if they're not in that terrain, then, you know, often what happens is that thoughts will lead to unnecessary thoughts. And the unnecessary thoughts begin to be the terrain where we get reactive. So this leaping point for us, where we leap from thoughts that are useful, true, necessary, kind, to unnecessary, reactive. What happens there? I mean, sometimes it's about entertainment in our mind. Sometimes it's like, you know, we think of something and the mind just wants to entertain itself and make ourselves feel some way or other. Or it might be constructing useless stuff, you know, just random noise. Or it might be, I mean, this is a big one for us. It might be that there's some kind of feeling of injustice, a feeling of that person shouldn't have done that, a little bit of self-righteousness, a little bit of anger and frustration around how somebody has behaved, either with respect to us or somebody else. This is huge. This is a huge area of leaping for us. And it's particularly sticky for us, that particular one, because there's some truth to it, some discernment to it perhaps, some compassion to it. You know, that we see that, oh, you know, that person was behaving cruelly, either to myself or others. And you know, that you know, there's some sense of that it shouldn't be that way. And the mind will react to that with anger and judgment and frustration. And there is some, perhaps some validity to the reactivity, but there's some validity perhaps to that person created harm. Or that person behaved in a way that was not skillful. So there may be some truth to that, that is what happened. And yet what we begin to see as we explore this is that when our own minds get reactive in that kind of a situation, when our own minds move into anger and self-righteousness, it doesn't leave a lot of space for compassionate, wise action. Instead, we start yelling at the person and telling them how stupid they are and how unkind they are or whatever, you know, or in our minds we do that. We think, they are being so stupid or whatever, or they're being so cruel, or it shouldn't be like that. Well, it is the way it is. I mean, this is one of the things about our meditation practice, and I think it's an area where there tends to be a little bit of confusion. That as we open to our reactivity, as we open to what's happening in the world, as we see what's going on, and we see certain things are not helpful in the world, certain things are not helpful in our minds, you know, unskillful actions in the world, unskillful actions in ourselves and in others. We see that, and we feel like, yeah, it shouldn't be like that. The world should be another way. What can I do to not contribute to that? And that's a beautiful aspiration. What can I do to not contribute to that? Or what can I do to support the movement away from that unskillful behavior in the world? What can I do for that? That's a beautiful aspiration. It's motivated by compassion. And yet the mistake that we sometimes make is that we deny or we kind of feel reactive about what's already here. And in the meditation, we think perhaps, oh, I'm not supposed to be reactive, which means I'm just supposed to sit here and not do anything. And that's not exactly what the meditation and what our practice is pointing to. It is pointing to being present and available for things as they are, which may be things as they are, may be that people have behaved unskillfully or unskillful things have arisen in my own mind. So things as they are may be that. And then the compassionate move is to take skillful action. The skillful move is to bring wisdom to the equation. And when the mind is reactive to that experience, the mind is caught in its frustration and anger and impatience and self-righteousness, wisdom is not so available. And so the practice is to really open to these situations. Not to simply say, oh, things as they are, but to acknowledge, yes, it is this way, and how do we move forward? Skillfully, appropriately, with an appropriate response rather than a reactive response. Appropriate response based in compassion, in wisdom, in kindness, as opposed to anger and hatred and frustration. One of the key verses in the Dhammapada: hatred never ceases through hatred, but through non-hatred alone does it end. And so this is part of our exploration in our daily life practice, to begin to be to open to what's here and to learn what does it mean to meet that reactivity, to not act on that reactivity, but then to not think it means non-action. This is a challenging area, but it is the terrain of becoming aware of what's happening, of beginning to be available for reactivity in daily life, and all of the thoughts around it. You know, that leaping point, that moment when we leap from necessary thoughts to unnecessary thoughts, and seeing the whole, I'll be talking for a while, and seeing that whole kind of pattern around that begins to support our ability to shift from unskillful response to skillful response. So the next piece that I want to look at is the reactivity. You know, how do we explore that in our own hearts and minds in daily life? Again, you know, this is so challenging for us. And one thing I want to start with is that, you know, there's kind of four, for myself, you know, four basic guidelines that I use in daily life practice. One, just notice what's obvious. You know, first of all, be very compassionate with yourself because it's going to happen. You're going to react. You're going to behave unskillfully. The conditioning, the kind of momentum of our habits is so strong that simply the intention is very powerful, the intention to begin to wake up for our reactivity in daily life, but it's a slow process. It's not going to happen immediately. It's not going to be something that we decide, oh, I'm gonna wake up for when I'm angry and I'm not gonna react out of my anger anymore. It's like, it will take some time. So that intention, setting that intention and not giving up on it is really useful. And yet, first of all, compassion for yourself for the fact that it's hard. It's not gonna be easy and it's not gonna be quick. Then notice what's obvious. In the moment when you notice reactivity, this requires, you know, mindfulness. So notice what's obvious. Just really simply, notice what's obvious. Oh, tension in the body, constriction in the mind, feeling of pushing forward, feeling of wanting to withdraw, whatever it is. Kind of the immediate kind of gut feeling, gut sense of what's obvious right now. Spinning mind, confusion, whatever that is. Just notice what's obvious. Ground yourself in non-harming. Second suggestion, you know, what? Remembering that non-harming is so important in our actions. That, you know, we don't want to harm people, and often when we do, we regret it later. You know, so if you can, you know, just remember, okay, right, non-harming is a priority. Ground yourself in non-harming. Trying to refrain from acting out of reactivity if possible. And get really good at cleaning up the mess. Because there will be messes. And so, you know, what does that mean? It means learning to take responsibility for the ways that we've been unskillful. You know, apologizing, for instance, or making amends, and also, recognizing the dukkha, the suffering that comes from when we do behave unskillfully, that, you know, not be a point of self-flagellation, of beating ourselves up, but be a point of, oh, it's like this when I've created harm. Yeah, that doesn't feel so good. You know, there's a fine line between the kind of sense of remorse, of skillful remorse about having done something that caused harm, and guilt. Guilt kind of feeds back on itself. It's like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Yeah, I'm such a bad person. Oh, I'm horrible. I'm never going to be a good person. And you know, we take that guilt on, as opposed to with skillful remorse, it's more like, yeah, I did that. It was unskillful, and it had these consequences. And taking in the way that feels supports our basically wanting to behave more skillfully in the future. And so it's a little bit of an art, learning how to truly acknowledge and be skillful with our own mistakes. But it's a huge part of our practice, especially in daily life. So notice the obvious. Ground yourself in non-harming. Refrain from acting out of reactivity if possible. And get good at cleaning up the mess. So one thing that I found really helpful in exploring reactivity in daily life is to kind of pick an area, pick something, pick a particular habit, pick a particular kind of reactivity that is really familiar to you and one that you're interested in understanding. I think the interest is such a key point to this, because the interest will motivate the exploration. And I did this, my very, very first mindfulness practice, and many of you have heard this story before many times, but it's so relevant here to talk about. You know, my very first mindfulness practice was paying attention to my anger. Anger was ruling my life. It was creating, you know, basically I was in a non-functional state some of the time because the anger got so strong. And I had kind of hit bottom in my life around the anger and the hatred and the feeling of resentment and betrayal that came around this particular situation. And, you know, it's like I didn't quite know what to do. But I got this, you know, instruction about, well, why don't you try paying attention to your anger instead of letting it kind of run rampant. And I began exploring that. And so there was a lot of interest. I had a lot of interest because the anger was taking me down into despair, into confusion, into frozenness, into non-functionality. It was basically, you know, basically destroying my life. And so I was motivated to understand it. And somebody had sent me a book saying, try these things. And it's like, well, I had no idea how it would work. You know, how paying attention to my anger would help, I had no idea. But I was willing to try that and began just in a very simple way. Oh, anger's happening right now. And so picking something for me in that initial situation, and this was entirely daily life practice. In fact, for the first 3 months of my mindfulness practice, I did not meditate. I was not interested in meditating. I never thought I would be interested in meditating. But I was interested in understanding my mind and began just waking up. Oh, this is what it's like to be angry. This is the experience of anger. And so picking that was helpful because it was very specific. You know, it was something that I was it was a problem in my life, and it was like repeated over and over and over again, and it was taking me further and further down. And so there was motivation to understand it, but it also happened a lot. And so just starting to watch it, and in daily life, you know, and this was kind of intuitive, my first, you know, couple months of practice. And in some ways, I benefited from the fact that I was, you know, very far from anybody who could teach me about meditation. Because all I knew was, okay, just be aware of the anger when it happens. And when I became aware of that, it's like, well, what do I do with this? You know, I don't know what I'd do with this. I didn't have any instructions about, pay attention to your body, or look at your thoughts, or notice where the holding is, or any of that. What I did instead was, I don't know what I do with this. I guess I go on with my day. And that actually, in retrospect, was kind of a wise thing to do. You know, just especially in daily life. It's like, if we, in daily life, this is a big, you know, confusion. You know, we're in the midst of something. We notice we're reacting. And we think, oh, you know, I'm having this conversation with somebody. And, oh, wait, stop, stop the conversation. Let me, like, you know, close my eyes and pay attention to my body. And, like, it's like, you know, that's not going to happen. Notice what's obvious in that moment and go on with your day. Do the best you can, noticing what's obvious. What I discovered in that, in those moments of the mindfulness acknowledging, oh, this is anger, it did take my foot off the gas pedal for even a few moments. Allowed me to switch focus to something else, which allowed the anger to just roll away. You know, it's kind of like that unwinding, that, you know, the momentum of the car coming to a stop. So that, you know, oh, this is, wow, yep, anger, okay, I guess I go on with my day. And in daily life, that's a big part. That's the notice what's obvious. Notice what's obvious and go on with your day. You'll get another opportunity. You get many opportunities with these repeating patterns. And each time it happens, you learn something new. In a small way, we learn something new. You know, my practice around anger yielded amazing understanding within only a few months. And so that simple process of, ah, here it is again, can I know this, and go on with my day. Even if you're in the midst of a conversation, just noticing, oh, there's that impatience again. It might create the conditions for a little pause, a little sense of, okay, I can hang out with this for a few moments. As opposed to immediately jumping, as opposed to immediately reacting. So that just to notice what's obvious over time really begins to support us. And this is one of the most powerful fruits of daily life practice, that we, if we are willing to be interested instead of, you know, feeling like it's you know, something that's wrong with me. You know, okay, that the patterns, the conditioning that led to those patterns of reactivity. You know, it's like it's been shaped over so many years. And the momentum of that is pretty powerful. Often it comes from, like, underground. It comes from almost subconscious impulses, that reactivity. And so if we think that my deciding to pay attention to this is going to, like, undermine those or undercut those subterranean patterns and conditions in a few days, it doesn't work like that. And yet what does happen over time, and I've seen this over and over again, is that the willingness to meet our pattern, like for myself, that willingness to meet anger over and over again, the willingness to, oh, there's anger again. Okay, there's anger again. It's like the conscious awareness of the pattern of anger began to get much more present. It's like in my first few weeks of doing this, it's like the anger had to get pretty strong for me to notice it. I was like, you know, sitting frozen at my computer before in a rage before mindfulness would surface. And then over time, I began to notice, even over just the first few weeks of this practice of just like, I'm going to be mindful whenever anger happens in my life. I began noticing that something about that acknowledgement, oh, there's anger again, notice what's obvious, just that simple practice began to insert the mindfulness sooner in the process. so that the anger was nowhere near as strong, and it's much easier to be with. So within a few weeks, I was experiencing the benefits of mindfulness in this repeating pattern. And then even began to see kind of the subterranean thoughts that would lead to that pattern. So what mindfulness does, at least in my experience, is like almost like it lowers the horizon of the subconscious. That the, you know, things that were, you know, kind of operating beneath the surface, little thoughts that lead to reactive patterns, they begin to be available. And at this point, I am not sure there's any fixed boundary at all to the subconscious. You know, I think that it's possible with mindfulness to see the deepest kind of shifts and changes that lead to our reactivity. And the more sensitive we are to those shifts, the more we wake up. We wake up more quickly in those patterns. So I can probably talk about this for weeks, but I want to leave some time, so I'm going to stop now and see if there's any comments or questions or thoughts. Yeah.
Well, it occurred to me when you were talking before that in Taoism, there's this concept, which is at least translated in English as actionless action. Mm-hmm. And what you're conveying here is something very similar, but might be labeled reactionless action.
Okay. That, yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the it's interesting that the, you know, when we are reacting, there's often a lot of sense of I or me or doing in the, even though it's happening kind of like out of conditioning. It's happening out of reactivity. That reactivity is embedded with a lot of sense of, I need to do this, I'm right, they're wrong. So it's got a lot of that I in it. And when that sense of reactivity begins to diminish, and it's there's a motivation out of compassion or kindness, often it doesn't have as much of a sense of me in there. It's more of a, in fact, it may feel more like a sense of we. You know, it feels more like a sense of us, that there's this situation that we're in, and how do we move forward with that? And so it's less of a sense of ego-driven action, and more of a sense of heart-driven, heart-responsive action. Yeah. Yeah. And would you hand the mic forward?
I've been reading a couple books that have to do with the unconscious, that studies have shown how unconscious most of our decisions are. And so that's why mindfulness is a way to bring to consciousness.
Yes. Yep. And if we are not mindful, our preconditioned habits are making our choices for us.
Exactly.
And when we can begin to be mindful, those choices begin to be more conscious. And so we can choose skillfully. Sometimes our preconditioned habits and patterns are skillful. I'm not saying it's wholly bad under there. But at least we become aware of when choices are skillful and when choices are not skillful. And when they're not skillful, we can kind of try to steer the battleship in a new direction.
You know, and it's funny, when I start to read something, everything that I read says the same thing. It's just amazing to me that was such a big thing for me to realize how much of mine are patterns, and they're long-term patterns.
Yep.
And so that it's just amazing, when I need something, it comes. Just like today, I really needed to hear this. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, you know, those long-term patterns that are under there, you know, sometimes when we see the depth of that and how deeply conditioned they are, You know, I remember at one point seeing my self-hatred. It was on retreat, looking at self-hatred over and over and over again, and seeing just how deep it went. It's almost like my mind understood, like it was in there from like really early on in my life. And there was a little bit of a sense of, oh, this is huge. You know, this is like, you know, I'm going to have to be fully enlightened for this to go away. And yet, that's not true. There's so much power. Mindfulness is so powerful when it is exploring in this way. And so, you know, when we start to see, when we turn our mindfulness towards our patterns and habits and see the depth of them, don't despair. Because it is, that mindfulness is more powerful than the depth of those patterns.
It's a lot of work.
Yes, it's a lot of work. And yet, it's worth it. Did you have something? No? Okay. Anyone else? Anybody have a particular pattern they're working with that they'd like to explore a little bit?
I read in the newspaper this morning that our culture, our contemporary culture, is infused with sarcasm. Hmm. I don't know if that's true, but I know my culture is infused with sarcasm. And and the suggestion in this article was that that the sarcasm comes out when one is feeling inferior or down, and the sarcasm serves temporarily to put one in a superior position.
Oh, interesting.
That all fits me, one of my patterns. So I can't say that I'm working on it, but I just got an insight to work on it, and of all places in the murky news.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of sarcasm, wasn't it?
It can get subtle, you know, get subtle, you know, and it is also, it's like, this also points to the way that our patterns happen. You know, it's not just about what's going on in here. Like, we are responding and receiving what's happening in the world. And we are shaped by that. And so, you know, one of the things the Buddha said is, like, this practice of turning towards mindfulness, towards non-reactivity, towards not engaging out of reactivity, but engaging out of compassion and kindness. It's like swimming upstream. Even in his day, I mean, you know, it's like swimming upstream. The culture kind of has a lot of that momentum, and that's what we've learned. You know, that's we've been immersed in it since we were kids, you know, this culture of sarcasm, this culture of greed, this culture of consumerism. You know, we've been immersed in it. Of course it's happening in us. And so if we, you know, feel like looking into these patterns that it's going to go quickly, you know, we're swimming upstream. But it's possible. And picking small things like that, you know, small things like sarcasm, you know, it's like it opens a doorway to beginning to see how your mind works. And, you know, just that, like just seeing that, oh, that was sarcasm too, you know, just feeling into what was that, you know. It may be that initially it's like you've just noticed that you've been sarcastic. What's the feeling? Right there. You know, you don't have to back up. It's like, oh, right there. Ooh, you know, a little bit of tightness, a little bit of something. So just exploring it. And now we have to stop. So thank you.